Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, I'm Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast. I am so excited to be talking about 90s music today, and we're talking about Soundgarden, one of my favorite bands of the 90s. I'm talking with Greg Prado, who wrote a really great book called Dark, Black, and Blue, and we're going to be talking about that book. Be sure and follow me on social media if you're not, and be sure and subscribe if you haven't already. Let's head on over to the interview. This is Greg Prado. Well, Greg, thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast today. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you for also inviting me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love it when I can time reading a book and then getting to talk to the author. And I did that with this case. And so I finished your book, Dark, Black, and Blue, which is the story of Soundgarden. And, you know, first off, I've got several questions for you. But the first one is, you know, when people look at Seattle, they look at grunge and they look at the impact, the bands that are always, there's the top four, you know, always Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, and Soundgarden. Do you think that Soundgarden ever had a chance of being the number one? Did they ever have a chance? They always felt like they were the underdog. And when they got really popular with Super Unknown, it felt so validating as a fan for some reason. Do you think they ever had a chance of being the top band, or did you think they were?
Yeah, well, there was a spell in the late 80s where they were definitely the top band coming out of Seattle, because they were the first band to get signed to a major label from the whole entire grunge, the whole grunge movement. So I would say probably from 87 through probably 90, they were the top band. Then, of course, once Nirvana put out Nevermind, then that totally shook everything up.
Well, for these guys, they're an eclectic group of guys. Can you tell just briefly, like, how did they get together? How did Chris and the guys meet and start to form Soundgarden?
Yeah, sure. Well, Kim Thiel, who's the guitarist of Soundgarden, was friends with Hiro Yamamoto, who was a bass player. They were from, I believe, Chicago, or actually close to Chicago. And they both moved to Washington around the Seattle area to go to college. And this would have been in the early 80s. And then from there, I believe, was Hiro befriended Chris. They were playing in a cover bar band. And then through that, Kim met Chris, and they actually played in the bar band, but it was all just like kind of crappy covers. And Kim said he wasn't even really that impressed with Chris at first, because he just assumed that Chris was just interested in doing covers, that he wouldn't be interested in doing anything that was completely original. But then they eventually became more friendlier. And then they decided to start jamming, and originally it was Chris on drums and singing, and Kim on guitar, and also Hiro on bass. And then, and then eventually they got a drummer, because Chris wanted to focus solely on singing and also playing rhythm guitar. And then eventually that led to Matt Cameron around 1985. And then Hiro left just as the Louder Than Love album came out in 1989. Then Hiro was replaced by Jason Everman, but he only toured with the band, and then he would have left in 1991, and then he was replaced by Ben Shepherd, and then that right there is the Soundgarden lineup that everyone knows best, which is Chris, Kim, Ben, and also Matt.
And for people that know the band, they will know that Matt Cameron went on to drum for Pearl Jam and is still the drummer for Pearl Jam. Which is so cool to see the lineage kind of pass through and that it's still going. But you made a good point on the other question about they really were the big dogs. They were the big band in town, especially getting started. When you look at the landscape of music in the 80s, it's hair bands and it's this other entire type of music that's going on. When these guys are really pioneering a new sound, birthed out of Seattle, do you think that had to do with the landscape of where they lived? And I mean, I'm remembering interviews I've seen with Cornell talking about it, like from the Pearl Jam documentary, that, you know, we spent a lot of time indoors. Do you think that helped them craft their sound and their songwriting skills?
Oh yeah, I would say 100%. Yeah, that where they were from played a huge part. The fact that they were so far away from, say, like your average Los Angeles or like New York type of place, they just they could focus on doing their own thing, playing clubs. There was no pressure of playing showcases or shopping around demos or anything like that. They were just in their own little separate location, and they could just focus on just doing what they loved. And it seemed like all those bands were really into the same type of music. They were all into the like bands like Stooges, MC5, and then were also bands such as Chrome, Butthole Surfers, Meat Puppets. So it was, they were all kind of listening to the same bands. It seemed like they all had like the same kind of records in like all of their record collections. And it just so happened that all those bands were in the same location. And to the best of my knowledge, the first three bands to get signed to major labels out of that scene would have been Soundgarden, Mother Love Bone, and then the third would have been Alice in Chains. Those are the first three to get signed to major labels.
What of their catalog? Just when you find yourself listening to Soundgarden albums, what's your go to? What's your favorite one? If you had to say,
it's really a two way tie between Bad Motor Finger and also Super Unknown. It really depends. It's pretty much like whichever one I'm actually listening to at that time is the one that I think is the better one. But it always changes, really. Like that could have been the ultimate double album if both those albums were a double album. But then again, that probably would have been about 6 or 7 records because both those albums are very, very long.
That is true. Well, it's interesting when you talked about the timeline. And I don't like I'm somebody that's been way into this for a long time, and I forget the timeline of, oh my gosh, like Bad Motor Finger came out, and Pearl Jam's 10, and Metallica's Black Album, and Alice in Chains, I think. I don't remember the other. There were all these albums. Never mind. All these albums came out so close to each other. I feel like that as somebody who was listening to it come out, I was just blown away by how good the content was, how good the music was. And now, obviously, I think it's good enough that we're still talking about it. Do you think that the 90s was particularly unique in as a movement in music, or is it just that some of us like were really connected to the music, or do you think it's that it's such a high level that that's why we're still talking about it?
I mean, there's certain years in the history of rock music that just, it so happens that a lot of classic albums come out, and definitely 1991, a lot of classic albums came out. In fact, I also write for the Guitar World site, and I just recently put together, it was a list titled, I have it right here, let me tell you the list. The 30 greatest rock guitar albums of 1991, and I go through the whole list, and nice. You know, there's the expected ones such as Nevermind, 10, Bad Motor Finger. Alice in Chains' Facelift actually came out in 1990, but it hit in the summer of 1991, so people tend to think that that's when it came out. Yeah, but 1991, you also had Blood Sugar Sex Magik. You had Blood Sugar Sex Magik from the Chili Peppers. You had Gish from Smashing Pumpkins. Mm. You also had Queen's last album with the great Freddie Mercury called Innuendo. You also had the Temple of the Dog album. You also had Lenny Kravitz, Mama Said. You had the first Mr. Bungle album. You had Fishbone, The Reality of My Surroundings. So you definitely had a pretty wide variety of albums that are now considered to be classics.
Man, and it was exciting to be hearing those. And I remember hearing Temple of the Dog specifically because I was already in a Pearl Jam. And I was like, whoa, is that the Soundgarden guy? Whoa, and the Pearl Jam guy? I just remember being so excited about it. I thought there was an interesting thing that I picked up on from, I think you were quoting some of the Soundgarden guys. I don't have the exact quotes. But they were talking about bands like Stone Temple Pilots. And it was interesting because like when you talk about, being from Seattle for Soundgarden and kind of the thing that was put forth was authenticity and we're not going to glam it up. They're just going to be themselves on stage. But the music, you hear Stone Temple Pilots and it's lumped into grunge and it kind of isn't, I guess. But it seemed like it was looked down a little bit because they're from LA or there was a different vibe coming from them completely. Do you think that was just territorial based, or do you think there was more than that?
What's funny is Stone Temple Pilots at the time was definitely like people pointed to them as a band that shouldn't be considered quote unquote true grunge. But looking back, pretty much what it is their first album I could see was very highly derivative of grunge. You could say that Scott Weiland sounds a lot like people like Layne Staley, how he's singing, and also, of course, Eddie Vedder. Yep. But as Stone Temple Pilots albums went along, I thought they actually became their own band. And I don't think you can deny that after their first album, I thought they became actually a really, truly, truly a great band. So, and then also, I mean, you look at how bad rock music has actually become that mm-hmm. a band like Stone Temple Pilots is a fantastic band if you consider it how bad and derivative music is now. But yeah, I mean, Stone Temple Pilots, I mean, you could look at the history of rock music. There's always some bands that took a few albums for them to find their own sound. You can look back to Rush, like their first album was very derivative of Zeppelin, but then they eventually found their own sound. You could say the first Radiohead album, I personally didn't really care for, even though it had the hit song Creep on it, but then they eventually became, you know, great. So yeah, I mean, it just it takes. Yeah, and then also the thing too, which is funny, is I know at the time people pointed to Stone Temple Pilots like, oh, they're not from Seattle, so they shouldn't be considered grunge. But if you look at bands such as Soundgarden, Kim Thayil wasn't from Seattle. He's originally from Chicago. So is Hiro Yamamoto. Yeah. Matt Cameron was originally from, I believe, San Diego. And then you look at Pearl Jam. Eddie Vedder was all. Yeah, it was from Chicago, and then I think San Diego. So it's not like that all the bands were, you know, pure Seattle bands.
Well, I love Stone Temple Pilots, especially, like you said, the second record, Purple, I think is just one of my favorite albums of the 90s. But let's talk about Temple of the Dog for a minute. So Chris Cornell's roommate, Andy Wood, was the lead singer from Mother Love Bone. He passed away because of a drug overdose that severely affected Chris and all that music community is what it sounds like. And Chris started writing these songs for the Temple of the Dog album that ended up being Chris as the front man and then the Pearl Jam guys backing him and Matt. How cathartic do you think those songs were for him as a songwriter dealing with the loss of a friend and being able to express it through the songs that he wrote?
Yeah, I think it was very, very cathartic for Chris because Chris and Andy Wood were actually roommates at one point, and I know that he was also very close with Andy. So yeah, I think, you know, that's one thing that's so great about music is it helps you get through some really like bad times. And yeah, just the fact that he could then hook up with two of the guys from Mother Love Bone, with also Mike McCready, who was soon to be in Pearl Jam, and also Matt Cameron. Yeah, that must have been very cathartic for someone like Chris.
Have you gone down the rabbit hole of watching? I don't know if you went to any of these shows, but you know, Temple of the Dog reformed just a couple years before Chris died, and there's some killer live videos of those shows. I didn't get to go to any. Did you go to any, or have you seen any of those live videos from that tour?
I've seen some live videos, yeah, and I thought it was great, but no, I didn't get to see any because the closest one to where I live was Madison Square Garden, and it sold out very quickly. So yeah, I didn't get a chance to go see that.
Yeah, me either. But for people listening, if the Temple of the Dog, if you do a search for live shows, there are some killer recordings on YouTube. I like the part when you talk about, you know, because Temple of the Dog kind of came out right before Pearl Jam came out, but I like where you describe Chris Cornell carrying Eddie Vedder on stage for one of the first either Mookie Blaylock or Pearl Jam shows. And I think you said Chris was carrying Eddie Vedder on his shoulders, and he like kind of put him down and he was pointing at him as if to say to the crowd, like, this is your guy. This is your guy now. How important of a moment as far as validation do you think that was for Eddie, for Pearl Jam in the scene as a whole?
Yeah, that was absolutely huge. That was actually a quote that was Susan Silver, who was Soundgarden's original manager and also Chris Cornell's ex-wife, said that. Yeah, she said that one of the first Pearl Jam shows, I believe they were actually opening up for Alice in Chains, I could be wrong. Yeah, Chris carried Eddie out as to, like what you just said, as to say that this is your guy now. You know, they were all still grieving about the loss of Andy, but that he, you know, and I guess by him doing that, since Chris was also loved by the whole scene, that was obviously, you know, that shows what type of person Chris was. Because in the book, you know, people talk about how he was, you know, if you look at pictures of Chris, he's always wearing shirts of other bands, such as Pearl Jam, mm-hmm. before they were popular. And Nirvana. In fact, what's interesting, the first time I ever even heard of the band Nirvana was a picture I saw of Chris Cornell in 1989 wearing a Nirvana shirt.
Yeah, I've seen that, yep.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, so he was, you know, he's someone that was really great as far as supporting local talent.
What about when you talked about his look a little bit there, and it made me think of Outshined. Can you tell the story a little bit about, you know, him writing the song Outshined, where he's talking about the lyrics of looking California, feeling Minnesota, and how people connected to that song in particular when he didn't expect they would?
Right. Well, yeah, the phrase looking California and feeling Minnesota, I remember he said at the time, and I think it's included in the book, he says that's his way of saying that he was feeling bad because you think of, you're looking California, meaning that you're, you know, dressed in shorts or whatever, but then you're feeling Minnesota, meaning that you're in a freezing cold place. So that was his way of just saying that he was just feeling, I guess he was feeling not that great at the time. But, yeah, one thing that's interesting about Chris's look is if you look at all the photos from the Bad Motorfinger era, he's always shirtless and he's like this, you know, great kind of like shining rock god. But one person I spoke to for actually the Grunge is Dead book, which was a book I put out about 10 years ago, which I included a lot of quotes from in this Soundgarden book. I interviewed Mark Arm from the band Mudhoney. And he had some really, some very, very interesting things to say, because although he, I think, does appreciate Soundgarden, and I know he's he's friends with some of the members, he's kind of, he was kind of critical of Chris because he said he couldn't really tell where, if Chris was trying to be serious with being like a rock god type thing, or if he was kind of mocking it. He said, you know, because you would, he, because Chris would go on stage with a shirt that would be like pre-ripped, so he could rip his shirt off.
To
expose his physique. But then ultimately Mark Arm said that Mark may just be jealous because his body is quote unquote not as hot as Chris's.
Yeah, so I was gonna ask you about that, but I thought that, you know, like for whatever reason that never bothered me about him, or that didn't bother me about him once I read it, because I thought, I always felt like he was playing into like a rock theme or a rock thing differently than like Kurt Cobain or Eddie Vedder. I would have never expected them to do it. But here in the Chris Cornell day, it was like, oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, he played with the shirt off a lot of times, and I can see that that could have been part of his thing. I don't know. That didn't bother me. But I thought that was interesting that it was from the Mudhoney guy.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Chris is probably trying to create kind of like a Robert Plant type of thing going on.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, so what happened between Bad Motorfinger and Super Unknown? Super Unknown is just, for me, it's my favorite, and I think the songs are so killer, and it's well recorded, and there's like pop elements and there's weird elements and there's dark. It's just such a dense record. Can you talk a little bit about like what was going on with the band between having some initial success with Bad Motorfinger and then leading up to the Super Unknown album?
Well, I know it took them a long time to get the Super Unknown album to sound just right, because I know there's a quote in the book where Matt says when they finished the album, they listened to it and they said it sounded really not good at all sonically. And they were all concerned that the album wasn't going to be, I don't know if it was going to be released or they're going to have to delay it, but it just wasn't up to, it wasn't as great as they were expecting it to sound. And they were able to get Brendan O'Brien, who's best known for his work with Pearl Jam and Stone Temple Pilots and all the other big bands. And he came in and he actually mixed it. And Matt said, Brendan went about it the complete opposite the way they recorded it. They recorded it with the producer, Michael Beinhorn, very slow. And it took a very long time. Whereas Brendan came in and just knocked it out very, very quick. And he said that's when the album really came to life. And that's when Matt was finally convinced that they had a great classic album. So that was a thing, too. So you think Bad Motorfinger comes out in late 91. Super Unknown comes out, I believe, in March of 1994. Mm-hmm. That's about 2.5 years right there. So yeah. You could see. I mean, the thing is, I think also what obviously took so long is because they were on the road for a solid year after Bad Motorfinger. They were opening up shows for Guns N' Roses. They were headlining their own shows. And then they were also part of Lollapalooza in 1992. So that also took a very long time for them to complete the whole entire tour. And then between that, Ben and also Matt put out a side project called Hater, which to me is probably my favorite, or at least one of my favorite Soundgarden side projects. It's like a garage type sounding, like a garage rock type band that not too many people seem to know about. And so that took up a bit in 93. And also they came out of the studio for a few weeks to play some shows with Neil Young and also Blind Melon in the summer of 93. And then that's when they went back and they finished the album. So yeah, I just think there was probably a lot of touring, you know, between those two albums. That's why there was such a long time between those two albums.
That makes sense. So one of the quotes that you had in there, I don't remember, I think it was from the producer, on Super Unknown, with who was interacting with Chris, and they were going through song possibilities for the Super Unknown record, and Chris was sending him demos and he was sending him the ideas for the songs they were going to do. And you talk about how the producer said he realized all the songs he sent him all of a sudden were very not one dimensional, but they all sounded the same. And the producer freaked out, like, I don't want them to release an album without a hit or without an album that's not commercial enough. And you talk about how he pushed back to Chris that he, when they were talking, they kind of talked about how Chris was writing songs that sounded like Soundgarden, and he told him to make something that he loved. And that's when he wrote Black Hole Sun, I believe. Can you talk about that a little bit, about that story, if you could, but also like how that songwriting style is different. So Black Hole Sun and some of those other songs on the song on the album are even more poppy in nature than their other work.
Yeah, I would say probably that album is the most Beatle-y Soundgarden album. And yeah, to go back to the story you just told, what it was Chris submitted to Michael Beinhorn, who was the producer of Superunknown, a cassette of songs that he wrote. And when Michael heard them, he said, yeah, you know, these are good, but it sounds like you're writing what you expect, like people, like you're writing things that you're thinking that a Soundgarden fan would expect to like or hear. And he said, rather than doing that, like, who are some bands that you like or listen to? And he said, I believe the two bands he listed were the Beatles and also Cream.
Yeah.
And so then he said, well, why don't you just write, you should just write like songs like that, like write songs that of bands that you're a big fan of. And Chris was concerned because he's like, well, I mean, is a Soundgarden fan really going to want to listen to a Cream psychedelic type song? And Michael said, yeah, of course, because it's you doing it. So mm-hmm. if it's you doing it, you're going to put it through your own kind of filter and it's going to come out sounding like a Soundgarden song. So he did that. And that's what gave us Black Hole Sun. And I believe on that same tape was also Fell on Black Days.
Man, gosh, two of my favorite songs they ever did. But I love that. I love the whole idea of don't write what people expect, write what you want, write what you love, and people are going to love it back. I thought that was really profound. And the song that he said, that Chris said he was most proud of, was 4th of July, which is one of my favorite Soundgarden songs. But I always felt like I was a loner on that because like it didn't get on the radio. But to hear him say that was super interesting. What do you think about 4th of July when you hear it now?
Yeah, I would say that's probably my favorite song. Probably my two favorite songs on that album are 4th of July, and I've always loved the song called Head Down, which was written by Ben. Mm. Those are my two favorite songs. Yeah, but I love the heaviness of 4th of July. That's probably, to me, the heaviest guitar sound that's ever been captured on record. Absolutely love that. And then also, like I said, the song Head Down has a very Beatle-y type thing, especially with the vocals. So those are my top two. And then, yeah, and then you think of all the other songs that were played on the radio. That's not even, those two songs weren't even played on the radio. So it shows what kind of a great album that is and how what a consistent album that was as a listen from front to back.
That's for sure. Well, I thought it was interesting because, you know, they were on tour. Like you said, Superunknown came out in 94. Kurt Cobain died in 94. And I thought that the band's reaction to his death was interesting. About them destroying the room that they were in because they found out the news. And then I'm just curious, what do you think that effect of Cobain's death had on a band like that was in a similar situation as far as being very popular at the time? And how do you think that affected the band and Chris specifically?
Yeah, I know I spoke to, it was a friend of the band for the book, and he talked about that Kim once told him that after Soundgarden broke up, this would have been like in the late 90s sometime. Kim told him, he said, you know, looking back, Kurt's death really screwed up the band because Soundgarden weren't home to grieve with their friends and family. They were all the way over in Europe at the time, and they had to keep on touring, so they never really had the time. And then after that, they went right into doing a U.S. tour. So they never really had the time to just kind of grieve properly. And then also, I know when I interviewed Matt Cameron, he talked about how, looking back, it was during the Superunknown tour that he said that the fabric of the band started to become undone a bit. And he said he couldn't really put his finger on it, but just they weren't as close as they once were. And that could probably you could probably trace that back to how, you know, Kurt's death pretty much took the wind out of everybody's sails at that point.
That's interesting that it would have such a profound effect on the band and even to feel those ripples. I just finished the Dave Grohl autobiography, Storyteller, and he talks about, he doesn't say that same story, but he basically said he wasn't able to grieve. He wasn't able to process it in kind of which is similar to like what you're saying with Soundgarden. He later was able to kind of channel that into positive songwriting, and that is a little bit of an outlet. But that's interesting to hear you say that that's the thing that Soundgarden took from it. I think it was Kim who said this quote about Cobain, and I thought this is crazy. I've never heard anybody say it like this. And he said, "I just want to know whether he won or lost, looking back at Cobain's life," which I thought was profound from the aspect of, gosh, look, when you look back, yeah, was it worth it for him to have gone on through all these things and to lose his life? So again, later, Chris, you detail about how Chris ends up taking his own life just a few years ago. I'm curious, the night of Chris Cornell's death, like, can you talk about a little bit about, not so much the night itself, but he'd gotten back on, I guess it was on painkillers, or he was on some kind of combination of drugs that were prescribed to him. And was there some kind of bad combo of medications that people think could have contributed to his decision to take his life that night?
Yeah, well, something I talk about in the book is not too many people know that. Well, I mean, I guess some people know that Chris had a addiction to, I believe it was painkillers, and I know in the late 90s he struggled with it, and it came to a head in the early 2000s. That's when he was putting together the band Audioslave. He had to go to rehab for a while. But I know there's a story in the book where Susan Silver, who was Chris Cornell's ex-wife, talks about in the 90s, the mid to late 90s, I think this was even before Soundgarden broke up, Chris was struggling with just issues that she said that he would come home or she would wake up and Chris would be curled up in a ball on the floor crying.
Right.
Because he was either, I guess, manic depressive or just the whole drug issue was getting to him. I'm not exactly sure what it was, but yeah, he was able to go to rehab sometime in the early 2000s, and he seemed to be doing well. That's what led to Audioslave forming, and then later Soundgarden getting back together. And then it seemed like somewhere along the line, I think a year or two before he wound up passing away, he had a I'm not sure exactly when he had a relapse, but he had a relapse before sometime before he passed away. And that is attributed to, or it could be attributed to why he took his own life. But I know in the toxicology report, I believe the original report said that whatever was in his system wasn't enough to kill him or had any effect on him. But I guess we don't really know for sure. Obviously, we're obviously never going to know for sure exactly what was going through Chris's mind when he decided to commit suicide.
The thing that I remember from the way they were describing it, what was in his system was a number of drugs, and I think what the autopsy said was it wasn't enough to the level that it would have killed him, but the combination of those drugs was not a good move. And in the whatever doctor was quoted in the book, he said something to the effect of someone with a history of drug addiction and of being on these different drugs should have never been on the medicine that he was prescribed. So yeah, it makes you wonder. For the song, so this is a dark turn, but the song "Pretty Noose" is that he wrote from Soundgarden is what I thought of as soon as I heard it. I was like, oh gosh, was he alluding to maybe doing that later when he wrote that "Pretty Noose" song? Do you think that's what he was talking about initially, even though that song was written years before, or do you think that was about something else?
I mean, it's possible because it's like, you know, not just Chris. You look back at the lyrics of Layne Staley, where he talks about heroin addiction, and that obviously wound up doing him in. And then you read or listen to Kurt Cobain's songs and lyrics, where he's talking about guns and everything like that, and also committing suicide. So, you know, and also Soundgarden, of course, had this song called "Like Suicide," so that that's there, of course. You know, so. Yeah, I mean it's hard to say, but you can't deny that there are definitely some signs with, you know, certain artists that eventually die or, you know, wind up committing suicide, and you look back at their lyrics that they have a whole new perspective of their lyrics, or you wind up reading into their lyrics a whole new way after they pass away.
That's certainly true. Well, another I want to connect it here a little bit, but Shannon Hoon is another singer who was the singer from Blind Melon, and he passed away. And you've actually written a book on him, which I'm super excited to read, and that's coming out this month for people that are listening to the podcast. Can you talk a little bit about that book? And was he similar to Chris in many ways?
Sure. Yeah, this is actually my second book about Shannon. The first one came out in 2008 called A Devil on One Shoulder and an Angel on the Other. And that one's probably, and also Grunge is Dead are my two most popular books as far as sales and also people getting in contact with me or, you know, me going on social media and seeing the very nice things that people have to say about them. And, that book came out in 2008 because I was a huge, huge fan of Shannon Hoon. I would say my favorite, my top singers of all time have to be Freddie Mercury, Chris Cornell, Shannon Hoon, and also Bon Scott of the great AC/DC. Those are probably my top four. But, nice. Shannon, I thought, was a simply fantastic talent who never really seems to get the credit that he really deserves. I think Blind Melon's second album, Soup, is one of my favorite albums of all time, if not the favorite. It's definitely up there with it's definitely up there with Super Unknown and you know all the classic albums. I highly recommend if you're not familiar with that album, you should definitely give it a listen. It's a great album. And so that one came out. That book, A Devil on One Shoulder, came out in 2008. And then about a few years ago, the world-famous photographer Danny Clinch put out a great thing. It was a film called All I Can Say, which what it was Shannon, during the last 4 or 5 years of his life, walked around with a VHS recorder or a camcorder. I don't know if it was VHS. And he walked around, and what he did is he pretty much documented his life, similar to what we do now with iPhones.
Right.
But he was doing it with a small camera he was carrying around. So he documented everything from pretty much Blind Melon forming, and there's even footage of him, sadly, in his hotel room the morning of the day he would later die. That came out 1 or 2 years ago, and after seeing that, I was just blown away. And I always go, it seems like almost every year I go through a phase, a really heavy phase of listening to the Blind Melon music that has Shannon Hoon on it. And listening to it and also watching the film and also going back and checking out a little bit of my first book, I realized there were a lot of people that I didn't speak to for the first book that I could easily now with the advent of the internet. Because when that first book came out, the internet was around, but it wasn't as easy to get in contact with people. Now it seems like with Facebook and Twitter, you can easily get in contact with people that were once kind of hard to get in contact with.
Yep.
So, pretty much what it is this book is simply titled Shannon. And it is coming out in early November, so by the time this podcast comes out, it will already be out. And that is available, like the Soundgarden book, through the website Amazon. You could buy that. And it's available paperback, Kindle, and also an audiobook version is going to be released very shortly with me reading it. And for this book, I interviewed Roger Stevens and also Christopher Thorne again. Those are the two Blind Melon guitarists. And what I did, I did a round table discussion with them. And there's about 4 or 5 different chapters where we talk about all different things with Shannon, just about memories of him. We also talk about what instruments they used on Blind Melon albums and just things like that. And I also was able to interview the actress who played the B-girl in the famous No Rain video. I finally was able to track her down.
That's cool.
I also interviewed Matt Pinfield, who is a longtime fan of the band. And and I interviewed several other people who are close to the band. I also interviewed Chad Taylor, the guitarist of the band Live, who toured with Blind Melon early on. So he has some great stories of when they toured together in 1992. And Travis Stever from the band Coheed and Cambria, who also was interviewed for the Soundgarden book, because he's a big fan of Blind Melon. So I interviewed a pretty wide variety of people. I even interviewed Shannon's young nephew. Well, he was then young. He was when Shannon passed away, he was, I think, in fifth grade. It was his nephew. I was able to track him down, and he's now an artist, a very talented artist. Mm. And I spoke to him, and he talked about what Shannon was like through his eyes as being his uncle.
Well, I can't wait to read that and listen to it. I listened to your book on Audible, so I'm sure we'll do the same. In conclusion on the Soundgarden side, when you look at what the band did and their legacy, what stands out to you is the thing that's going to be remembered about Soundgarden?
Well, I think it's ridiculous that Soundgarden is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, there's like so many bands that you look back and it just makes no sense. You know, when there's bands that get in that, you know, sure, they're very, very popular. But I mean, how many, you know, you look at some of these bands, they have not been influential at all. They sold a huge amount of records. You definitely can't deny that. But how many bands do these people influence? And certain ones, they weren't very influential at all. Seems like they just go pretty much by who Rolling Stone covers or who's headlining Madison Square Garden, who has the the most number one albums over the past 10 or 20 years. Soundgarden is one of the most influential bands. I think if you think about how many bands they influenced, also the wide variety of styles that they took on. Like I talked about before, there's no denying that Chris Cornell is one of the greatest singers of all time. Mm-hmm. You know, so the fact that they're not in it, but then again, you can look at, recently I've been listening a lot to the band, Sonic Youth. Mm. The fact that Sonic Youth isn't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is completely ridiculous. They were a huge fan on Nirvana. They were a huge fan on so many bands. The fact that they're not in, you could say the same about Thin Lizzy. You could say the same about MC5. The list keeps going on and on, how it's just ridiculous with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So anyway, to get back to your original question, yeah, Soundgarden to me is, I think they are the best grunge band. Of course, I love Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Alice in Chains, but to me, Soundgarden will always be number one, personally.
I love it. I love it. This is a side tale of that, but I have an ongoing conversation or debate between a couple of friends, and they'll say some big rock band who I really don't like, and they'll be like, yeah, but look how many sales they had. And I'm like, sales don't mean anything when it comes to the impact of the art. Like, who cares? There's some pop bands that have sold millions more albums than some of the best bands in the world. So that doesn't, in my book, it doesn't mean anything. I guess it does in some places for sure, but I just appreciate you coming on today, Greg. It's been a pleasure talking with you. For people listening, you can get the book Dark Black and Blue on Amazon or on Audible. I'm gonna have the link in the show notes, but certainly a very insightful read and enjoyed it very much. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Hey, I appreciate it. And also, I was going to say, if you want to check out my latest interviews or articles, because I write for a wide variety of sites and magazines, you can go to twitter.com/GregPratoWriter. I also have a link there to all my books, and you can check out whatever I'm putting out as far as books at the time or what my latest interviews are.
Awesome. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Thanks so much, Greg. I appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.